You're listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 12th of July, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Robert Bound, and this is The Big Interview, our one-on-one programme in which people with extraordinary lives, powerful careers, and maybe even tall tales to tell sit down and tell us what really happened, how they got here, and what makes them tick. Today, I'm talking to Milton Glaser, the artist and designer who changed the face, maybe invented the face, of graphic and architectural design from the 1950s onwards. There's so much iconic stuff that's flowed from Glaser's pen that it's tough to make a list, but Bob Dylan's psychedelic-haired greatest hits album cover from 1967 springs to mind. The foundation and design direction of New York Magazine in 1968 defined how city magazines were done. And Glaser, a native New Yorker, invented that thing we thought simply grew out of the ether, iHeartNY. Recently, the Brooklyn Brewery has become a household name thanks to Glaser's touch. The Hermitage Museum has celebrated 250 years in business and Glaser's repackaged that. The producers of Mad Men almost inevitably called on Mr. Glaser too. Milton Glaser was born in New York in 1929 as an architect of its visual identity, a mirror and a sounding board, and a Renaissance man with a pencil ever in hand. Glaser was educated at the High School of Music and Art and the Cooper Union Art School in New York, and via a Fulbright scholarship, the Academy of Fine Arts in Bologna, Italy. That's hardly the start of it. Milton Glaser, welcome to the programme. Tell us, I know that you don't want to talk necessarily in the past tense. Do you tend to think in the present or in the future tense?
I can't separate present from future, I must say, or past for that matter, either, since my memory has become so faulty. But the idea that at this ancient age, I'm still able to wake up in the morning and look forward to going to work is a great blessing, and I consider the great blessing of my life, as a matter of fact. So I love to work, and I love the idea that there's so much yet to be discovered, and that sense of a landscape with unlimited boundaries is still the thing that persists in my mind as an idea to follow.
And you said you love to go to work. I wonder how interested you are in the type of work that you do, in the universe of design, of graphic design, of communication, or whether actually your passion lies just in other stuff, in being interested in music and books and art and all sorts of other things that feed into it.
Well, people don't have a very clear idea what design is to begin with or what the distinction between design and art is, if any. And they are very distinctive activities. I mean, design is all about operating for a purpose. You have an aim, an objective, there's something to be done, and you try to solve a problem, or there's something that isn't working well, and you try to fix it. Or in a very elegant way, someone said, design is going from an existing condition to a preferred one. And I think that's what you do when you design things. The question of whether it's artistic or not is another question entirely, because art has no purpose outside of survival, and it stimulates the brain in another way. I would say that in both cases, whether you're doing art or whether you're doing design, the issue is how to stay attentive and how to pay attention to what you're actually doing. It's so easy not to be attentive to things, as you know. That's why you go through all these exercises to develop attentiveness and so on, as though you need another reason to pay attention. I mean, if you step off the street, you can be hit by a truck. But I dare say that you could have that attitude every moment of your life because you're going to be hit by something one way or the other.
I wanted to take it back. We've heard the introduction to you, and we talked about being such a prime mover in graphic design in New York City and across the world since the 1950s. What was it like back then? Whose work were you looking at back in the day? I mean, or were you always looking at artists instead of fellow designers?
Well, I divide my work between my general interest as an observer of art history, for instance, and the observation of myself trying to make things and the satisfaction that I derive from making things. I don't think there's any greater activity for any of us than making something that only exists in the mind and then becomes reality. So that transformation from something imagined to something real is a thing that has always driven me in terms of my own satisfaction. Still is. The extraordinary moment when you are working on something and you say, I found something. That great joy is something that I wish everybody experienced, because without it, life is almost without meaning. In any case, that general interest in how things are made and the history of art itself and sociology and the way the brain works and the relationship between words and music and visual things, all that stuff is the stuff of life. And I've always been kind of general in my interest about all of them. I was very interested in science when I was younger. Yeah. And I was a good potential scientist, I think. And then I got diverted by just the experience of making things and the notion of beauty. You know, intrinsic to all of this is a sense of beauty. And we don't know what that means either, or why things are beautiful on one hand and then in another culture they're not. Or even the question of preference, why you like one thing and don't like the other. Or what do we mean by attractiveness? What is an attractive person reduced from their personality to just an objective view of them? I'm always fascinated by that idea, and also by how ephemeral it is. You can be talking to someone, as I'm sure you have been, and having lunch, and at one moment say, oh, you're beautiful. And then a few minutes later, it may pass, and the person may seem like an ordinary human being. So
it's just the angle of the sun, maybe, sometimes, right?
So all those questions, I considered this thing, you know, not a profession. I mean, it really is my life. And professional life is, by and large, miserable, because it consists of the search for fame and money, which are corrosive to people. I mean, if something terrible happens to your brain and your behavior, if that's essentially what you're interested in. And in a culture like ours, almost everyone is programmed to be interested in that, interested in fame, despite, and celebrity, despite anything else, and the idea of, through that, making more money. Those things, they don't make you happy. What makes you happy, or at least speaking for myself and all the people I know, is making things. Seeing something that exists that has not yet been expressed, and then being able to express it in a way that seems fresh and different and personal.
And you've done all of that with a pencil in your hand or a pen. I mean, it seems to me like you talk and think, the hand is always moving, something is appearing on the paper.
Yeah.
Is that fair enough?
I'm a great believer in drawing, and not out of an academic activity, but the hand and the brain are related in a way that it's not easy to understand. In fact, a lot of people in psychology and brain studies think of the hand as another brain, actually, as an alternative brain. And I've said this before, but the action of drawing is like a mantra. It forces you into attentiveness. When you look at something to draw it for the first time, you pay attention to it. And most of your life, certainly a good deal of my life, I spend inattentive, not watching, not caring, not perceiving. And then when you have to draw something, that's when you galvanize your energy and force yourself to observe what's in front of you. I always give this example. When I first decided to draw my mother, and I was 16 or 17 years old, I'd never drawn her before, and we were sitting at the kitchen table in the Bronx, and I had a pad and a pencil, and I looked at her, and I realized I had not the slightest idea of what she looked like. I'd never seen her, that after all these years, confronted with the face I was most familiar with, of all faces I'd ever seen, I had no idea of what she looked like. And that made me very conscious of the immunity we all develop to seeing things and to life itself, unless we're forced into a circumstance where we have to examine what's in front of us. Sometimes this happens, you know, through failure and through pain and through difficulty. And those are the traumas of life that seem to make us aware of life itself. Otherwise, you're just drifting.
And every time you put pen to paper, you're kind of defining that, aren't you? How much are you like a butterfly catcher, someone chasing after a butterfly with a net and putting a pin in that butterfly and putting it in a case? And we can see how beautiful that butterfly is, but it's dead and it's stuck up there. Seems like you're always kind of chasing, you're always trying to redraw the butterfly instead of sticking it in a case, right? That spurs you on.
The thing about attentiveness is you have to work at it. I mean, if you don't, it doesn't happen. And in the same way that Buddhists will basically start the day with a meditation, You have to do it every day of your life or else it goes away. And
so it's practice. It's getting the pencil out. It's making sure
endlessly,
it's in your hand.
Endlessly. Yeah. And also there's a difference. I don't want to go too deeply into the technicalities of drawing and art making, but there's a difference between a drawing that is accurate and a drawing that is expressive. You see a lot of drawings that are accurate and very few that move the heart. And so the question is, what does that mean? It's very funny because you spend your youth trying to learn how to draw, as though that's a procedural secret. And there is only one way to do it, which is to do it. Every day you have to sit down, observe, and take that neurological path from the eyes to the brain to the hand and replicate something that's in front of you. And after 10 or 12 years, you're able to do that. You can actually do something in front of you that looks like what you're looking at. And then you discover that accuracy in drawing is not the problem. That when you learn how to do that, then you can go on to what the real problem is, which is make a drawing that moves the heart or moves the mind. And that is much more difficult to do.
I've watched a couple of films of you talking about a couple of your heroes, Picasso and Giorgio Morandi. And they're both very different characters, but you think they're quite similar. One, Morandi was a person that painted the same pots all of his life, and he was a teacher at Bologna University. Picasso was the great sort of hard-on-his-sleeve artist who, as you said in this film, wanted all the women and liked his fame and enjoyed it. Where are you in that nexus, Milton? Are you somewhere between the two? Are you?
Yeah, somewhere in between, because being essentially in the world of commerce, I mean, my world is the world of commerce. Yeah. It's to affect people on the street. It's to affect people to move to action. It has, by and large, intention. The other part of me, which is, I hope, parallel and equally powerful, is the desire to move something that affects the people who witness it and moves them towards a perception that they might not have otherwise, and also does them no harm. I mean, one of the problems of being in the life of a designer or people who communicate to others is that you have to make sure that in that communication, you're doing them good and not persuading them to do something that ultimately will not hurt them. And I find that a difficult issue. I mean, ethically speaking, how in this profession of persuasion, I mean, because a lot of times you're asked to persuade people to do something, you can avoid persuading them to do things that do them no good. I think that's not only a personal problem, but a cultural problem.
So that's an interesting thing that you want to, there is a sense in which you want to use the pen in your hand to move things forward rather than backwards, right? And to promote things that aren't going to cut people's heads off or shoot people or give people cancer or something. This is an ethical decision that you've made as well.
Well, you know, it gets very complicated because, as we know, good yields bad yields good, that the paradox of intention is very complicated. You could think you're doing something good by simply avoiding the real consequence of what you're doing. And we are so self-deluded about everything we do that it's hard to make a distinction between harm and being benign in a situation like that. But I am very nervous about persuading anybody. It's why I get nervous when an agency calls, that agencies are in the business of persuasion. And you have to be sure that what they are doing is simply in some way a general interest, that, you know, you can't persuade people to drink sweet things when they're children, sodas and pop and so on, without harming them. So you have to think about those things at least a little bit. It's all modified by whether you can survive without this kind of activity. And for most people who care about it, they choose their clients as carefully as they can.
I want to cast the net back and talk about two of the things we talked about in the introduction, talking about promoting the benign. New York City wasn't that in 1976 when I Love New York, I Heart New York, when that very rough treatment, it was a kind of back of the napkin job, wasn't it, to begin with, when that happened. New York was a bit of a benighted town, we're told, back in those days, almost bankrupt and dirty and dark. And, you know, tell us about the genesis of I Heart New York It's one of the elephants in the room, and I can feel its trunk tousling my hair. So we better address it.
You know, what's so funny is that when I did it, I said, I heart New York, but nobody knew what I was talking about. Now more people say, I heart New York than I love New York. I guess
right.
It sort of has entered into the culture.
It's part of the lexicon, and it's part of the, obviously, the visual identity of this city. And it seems like it ever was. It was interesting for me to find that it was only as old as 1976. It feels like, as I said, it's part of the ether.
I think it was 77 that was sort of entered into officially. Well, a guy came to see me from the Commissioner of Commerce's office, a guy named Bill Doyle, who had just been working in Hong Kong for a bank. And he said he had this new assignment, which was to put a face on the phrase that they had developed, which was, I love New York. And I've told the story a million times, so excuse me for not being passionate about it. But I did something, and I submitted it, and they accepted it. And then 2 days later, I was in a cab, and it just struck me that there was an easier, more obvious way to do it. And so I did a little sketch. I called Doyle. I said, look, I have something else I want to show. He said, no, I can't get these commissioners together. They all met, and they accepted your first proposal. I said, I really have something better. He said, let me see. So I went out to his office. I showed him. He said, yeah, you're right. This is better. He called up the commissioners. And as you know, in business life, you don't do things with commissioners. They're too busy to pay attention to anything. Anyhow, he got them together again. They said, yeah, this was better. And they actually chose the one that I had done in the taxi cab. And then it just started to enter into the culture. Now, it was peculiar because most thing you do as a designer lasts 3 weeks or 4 weeks. They all are ephemeral stuff. They're planned to be used for a certain period of time, and then they go away forever. But this just persisted, and there are reasons for it. One of which was that it wasn't simply an advertising slogan. It really reflected what the people in the city were feeling. And everybody was kind of upset about what was happening to the city. I mean, it was sort of decomposing before your eyes, and more crime on the streets and more dirt. And the city had lost its aura in the most significant way. People didn't want to come here anymore. And finally, somebody said, that's enough. We're not going to take it anymore. And it began to turn. And then this became a kind of a symbol of that turn. It was something people wanted to commit to. They said, I'm tired of all this negativity. I love this city. And so it became congruent with the feeling that was in the atmosphere. It was a statement that people wanted to make. It wasn't something they were driven to, like buying a product. I mean, they wanted to express their love for the city.
I wonder how controlled that is, who takes ownership of something like that, because it's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's been copied. Yeah. It's I love Hong Kong. It's I love London. Yeah. It's everywhere now.
Yeah, that's mysterious.
I mean, in that sort of...
Very mysterious.
Yeah.
For us, it's hard for me to believe something that happened, which was the transformation of a noun into a verb. But I mean,
a noun
to
into
say
a verb,
I heart something, you know, it's really basically twisting the language out of shape and incongruous. So the fact that it's odd that a heart was not used this way throughout human history. It was an addendum, and you always carved a heart with initials in it and a tree and so on. But no one ever said, I heart something. But once that became acceptable in some way because New York was doing it, it just spread all over in a way that was unprecedented. I don't know. Certainly nothing in my own experience or anything I've ever made has had that kind of worldwide effect where everybody was waiting to say, I heart something.
And the other great service to New York City was back in the late 60s was New York, the foundation of New York magazine. It's an amazing, it's something of a juggernaut. And it was then and it is now still. I mean, was that something that, I wonder whether your career could have happened in any other town? That you've absorbed such a lot of New York, and New York seems to have absorbed such a lot of your creative energy, whether you could have done it anywhere else.
Well, not exactly the way we did it. I had a partner, Clay Felker, who was a great editor, who came from the Middle West, and who always felt like an outsider, pressing his nose against the windows of the rich people eating dinner inside. And I was a kid from the Bronx. I mean, nothing was surprising to me about this city, and I loved the low end, the tenements, the rough life, and so on. And Clay and I, he was the editor of the Herald Tribune Sunday Supplement, which was called New York, and they went out of business. And I used to work for him. And one day we said, why don't we do it again? And let's see if we could find some money for it. So Clay knew some rich people, and he got the money together, and we just began in that kind of Mickey Rooney way, let's do a show kind of thing. And we didn't know what we were doing for the first year, I would say. But it represented two kinds of alternate visions of the city, one from the inside and somebody who was very familiar with it, one from the outside who was astonished by everything that happened. And I still think that it was one of the characteristics that made it work, because the city consists of just that kind of...
happy accident, right?
Yeah.
And can you plan for that? Have you ever tried to replicate that, you know, when you kind of go, we need an outsider and an insider, but we need two people that maybe don't feel they're invited to the feast all the time?
Everything is coincidence. I love that. Coincidence. My whole life has been bound by coincidence. You know that it's all about people you meet that you can get along with. And it doesn't happen very often. I mean, you meet the right person and you fall in love, or you become attached, or you feel that you have something you'd like to share and do together. I've had that several times in my life, I have to admit, and other projects, and they've always been extremely satisfying. And in my book of rules, the first thing I say is, don't work with people you don't like, or work only with people you like. I work with a guy named Steve Hindi, who owns Brooklyn Beer. And he walked into my office almost 30 years ago, and I liked him immediately. We started working together, and with Brooklyn Beer, it just became an enormously successful project that we've had a terrific time working on it. But from my own point of view, it's very hard for me to work with somebody that I don't share some common ground and don't feel close to and don't want to have lunch with. I mean, unfortunately, there are not too many people like that.
And yeah, you've written this about not confusing professionalism with affection, I think. Yeah. And so you have to have in business relationships the same sort of heart and soul that you'd have in a personal relationship.
Well, you want that. Otherwise, it's something else.
And this is about not chasing the money again, isn't it, somehow?
That's certainly one of the issues. Yeah, as a byproduct of that, you could make a lot of money, but largely as a byproduct. I mean, that's not the reason you do it, and that's not the reason you were attracted to do it. But I've made a lot of money from Brooklyn Beer inadvertently.
I'm sure the feeling is mutual. I'm sure people would love to know. People are always interested to know about the actual circumstances in which things are created. And rather than anything specific, I wonder what music you listen to when you work, whether you have anything on, whether you need to have almost a scientific, cool environment, or whether it's a scatterbrain. Which camp
are you in? I can work under any circumstances, day or night, standing, sitting, sleeping. I mean, because I essentially view the brain as this instrument that's far beyond our capacity to understand, that's working all the time. My discipline is very often go to sleep. I say, okay, tomorrow I have to do a book jacket for a new novel on World War I. And I just think about it. And then when I wake up in the morning, it's done.
Done in your head.
Yeah, in my head. I figured it out. I sleep. My brain keeps working. But I've always viewed it on that way, that the brain is infinitely generous if you allow it to be.
We've talked about some of those famous, you know, and very well-known things that you've done, and people will be familiar with hundreds of others. But what is it? Can you trace it back to something that you clicked when you were a child? Is there something, or is it just this endless experimenting with the pencil in the hand? The sort of DNA of all your work, does it go back to one thing, or does it just go back to whatever your brain has been working on while you've been asleep in the night?
Someone had a beautiful quote. They said, the mind is a very poor instrument for the examination of the self. So what you do is you create a story that has nothing to do with any reality or truth. I mean, I could say, well, when I was 4 years old, I fell on my head and the doctor that wrote blah, 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 blah. And it wouldn't be true. I mean, I don't know. It's all too mysterious and too wonderful. I mean, the idea that this imagery persists and that you can manifest it and you can move people, that there are ways of communicating that go beyond language, but that are compelling, and that you can. One of the great things of my life is the feeling that I'm doing what I was meant to do, which is that I learned how to communicate, and that in my communication, I have affected life around me and other people. And that is a privileged position. I mean, I don't look at that as being superficial at all. I mean, the fact that you are part of a larger community and can affect them positively is one of the great satisfactions of my life.
I wonder whether this score of amazing successes over the years, whether you have to be careful with people's response to your work, whether people are honest sometimes with your work as well. You know what I mean? Whether Picasso would, at the age of, 70, people were saying, well, this is amazing, Pablo.
Well,
you know what I mean? You have to be careful of the hagiography sometimes.
Well, you do something interesting in a book by John Berger on the success and failure of Picasso. He said after the invention of Cubism, which Picasso shared with Braque, he did Les Damsels, which was one of the great paintings of the 20th century. He said after that, the most terrible thing happened to him. He became aware for the first time in his life that there was an audience. And after that, Berger says, he never again did anything to equal the quality that had preceded it. And I think to some extent that makes an interesting point, which is that over-awareness of the audience or the critics while you're working is devastating. It really impedes free access to your own imagination.
And I wonder whether you have an idea of a heyday, not your own, but of this fantastic, feverish idea of creativity in the 60s, 70s, and the 80s as well. I wonder how you think about teaching, perhaps, and about computers, and about the way that design has changed, and maybe not enough people think with a pencil in their hand like you do and you did. Is that something that concerns you? Do you think we've moved on or not enough?
Well, I hate the word. Who would have believed that creative would be used talking about as a noun when you come in? And these on this right side, we have the creatives. The creatives. I mean, there has been, it is really a form of status for people, as though there were those who had it and those who didn't. And it's a nonsensical notion. I mean, for one thing, it can't be done without the work. I mean, first you have to do the work. And then if you know how to do the work, maybe it'll be unusual or distinctive. But you know what we mean by creative now in our culture is pretty low-level stuff. If somebody picks a right paint color to paint their living room, they're creative, or they know how to put a flower in a vase, they're creative. I mean, it's been trivialized to an alarming degree. But you experience it differently with people. I mean, people who are creative just because their imaginative response to things, even in conversation, is something that, you say, hey, I wouldn't have thought of that myself, and so on. But the culture is obsessed with creative, largely because it has become a selling tool. I mean, so everybody's creative, creative cereal makers or creative makers or whatever it is. Creative is basically a term used to sell products like everything else in our culture. So it's used very indiscriminately, I must say.
And before we go, what's tomorrow's problem that's going to be whirring around in your brain while you sleep tonight?
I'm trying to put together some new books that are not really books, but that are some kind of meeting between the visual and the literary that become sort of book objects. And I've just started, and I'm intrigued by the idea. I probably will not be able to find too many sympathetic publishers about this subject, but it's an idea that intrigues me.
Well, Milton Glaser, while the cogs whir as ever and hand sketches as you talk, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure to be with you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with Milton Glaser in New York, talking to me, Robert Bound. Tune in next week when our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, meets the hotelier, André Balage. For the time being, thanks for tuning in.